Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, has of course become considerably more challenging in recent years, as we have seen the effects of what a distinguished panel of experts, including our first guest, have concluded was a deliberate biological warfare attack against our country by the Chinese Communist Party, the so-called Wuhan virus, or SARS-CoV-2, if you choose to obscure the provenance of this Chinese, well, bioengineered weapon. And a man who has informed our thinking on this subject and brought incredibly important expertise to bear in making those judgments is our friend Dr. Stephen Hatfield. He is these days a senior fellow with the London Center for Policy Analysis. He is the author of 3 Seconds Till Midnight and has an extraordinary pedigree, more advanced degrees than you can shake a stick at, and a medical doctor's degree among them. And he is one of our country's foremost experts on matters involving biological warfare and how to defend against it. He participated, as I mentioned, in what we called our Team B study. It is entitled "The CCP is at War with America," and it provided a second opinion on some of the official statements out of the Biden administration and its intelligence community to the effect that we just can't tell where this nasty virus came from. Well, with Dr. Hatfield's very strong advice and counsel, we came to a very different conclusion. Dr. Hatfield, it's good to have you back, sir, here at Securing America. It's been too long. Welcome.
Yeah, good to see you, Frank.
I wanted both to, you know, I guess give you an opportunity to take a little bit of a victory lap. It seems as though by the day, there's more and more buy-in to what we concluded in the Team B study, namely that the Chinese Communist Party did engineer this virus in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and however it got out, they did send it around the world. Even the former director of the Chinese Center for Disease Control has acknowledged that that possibility cannot be excluded. What did you make of that, sir, and these other similar kinds of conclusions from the FBI and the Department of Energy as well?
Well, George Guo is the Chinese former director of the Chinese CDC. He seems to have been a straight shooter and an honest scientist from day one. And he's actually the one that sort of dimmed down the official story from China that it broke out in the Wuhan wet market. It's a live market with a lot of different animals in it. So George has been a pretty straight shooter around the whole thing, and we wish him well. It was extreme reluctance. A lot of it interfered with by the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. The director of the NIH, Anthony Fauci, MD, who were inadvertently funding to about $800,000 studies at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. This is always rather a ridiculous presumption when you're supplying money and expertise and talent to a nation that has a known active biological warfare program. This is just a complete lack of common sense. Yeah, well, they've stated it many times. So, you know, it was a bit of an outrage. And then to watch everyone try to cover this up, It was just a, these are the same people that have been involved in the abnormal domestic response, the pandemic response to the COVID-19 outbreak. Right.
And
same people that's what involved. I want
to go. Yeah, let's turn to that in just a moment, sir. But just a concluding thought. I believe Epoch Times has a report about a study by the Defense Department that just tore to shreds the paper that Tony Fauci relied upon, I think engineered for that matter, claiming that this came from nature. So this has been known for quite some time within the government of the United States. It's a scandal that it has been allowed to persist for this long, this false narrative. Yeah. But to your point, sir, about the pandemic response, you were working as an advisor to the White House when this pandemic broke out. And I remember you telling me that it was just astounding that the standing plan for how to deal with a pandemic was thrown over the side in favor of this, the China model, as it's been called. Walk us through again, how did that come about?
Well, it wasn't so much that. The National Pandemic Plan, which had gone through several iterations, including after the virus broke out, a rapid rewrite by the National Security Council, which probably didn't have the expertise to do that. But it was all based on early outpatient drug treatment. The concept of having a vaccine for this type of a rapidly mutating RNA virus, this was a non-starter. It would have been doomed from the start if we could have developed a proper vaccine in time, because the virus would have mutated away from it. The way you stop pandemics, epidemics, are by early drug treatment and quarantine. You go in to see your doctor, you're not feeling well, the doctor makes a judgment, not necessarily based on having a rapid test available, based on his own clinical experience and what's called a case definition that should have been put out by the CDC to help doctors do this. You make your clinical judgment, yes, I think you have COVID-19. You hand the drugs out, which we had 62 million doses of these drugs in the national stockpile very shortly after the pandemic broke out in the U.S., thanks to Peter Navarro and the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy.
Yeah. These drugs were not remdesivir, needless to say. Is that right?
Treating patient with a very expensive, remdesivir cost probably about $9 to make. And the company, Gilead, was charging the government several thousand, up to $3,000 for a course of treatment. Treating a patient in hospital when they've already been infected and have been out there spreading it doesn't bring a pandemic to the end. It may save the patient's life, not in the case with remdesivir, which we now know never worked. But the trick is for early outpatient treatment. Send the patient home on medication. Let them quarantine themselves at home. Perhaps even treat the whole family if the drug is safe enough. And the thing is over for that family within a week. And they have superior long-lasting natural immunity.
Yeah. Right. And drugs that you're talking about are drugs like hydroxychloroquine and
ivermectin.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And those were, of course, precluded under the protocols that were adopted. Dr. Hatfield, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about the pandemic next time and whether we're going to learn any lessons from this time. And more to the point, who we're going to have telling us what to do, right down to the level of you and your doctor. Stay tuned for more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The sad truth is that too many congressional Republicans amount to little more than a controlled opposition, full of rhetorical posturing, but when it matters, doing basically whatever the left demands. In January, Kevin McCarthy was compelled to promise, if elected Speaker, to oppose rather than submit to the Marxists running the executive branch and the Senate. His critics wisely required that the rules enable any one of them to depose him if he reneged. Barely 6 months later, it's clear that Speaker McCarthy has reverted to form. His so-called deal with Joe Biden on the debt ceiling is precisely what the governing leftists expect from opposition figures they control. It should be spurned by the Republican caucus and the Speaker's chair vacated to be filled by someone truly committed to opposing, not enabling, Obama-Biden 3.0's fundamental transformation of America. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Dr. Stephen Hatfill, world-class biowarfare specialist and medical doctor who had served early in the, well, I call it pandemic 1.0, in the White House trying to counsel how to proceed, only to have Tony Fauci and others essentially take a hold of the wheel and drive the cart squarely into a ditch. Dr. Hatfill, we talked a little bit about how you could and should treat a pandemic. We did the opposite. We did it in part, I think it's fair to say, not just because of Tony Fauci and his friends at CDC and elsewhere, but also because some outfit called the World Health Organization was in the mix. Tell us a bit about that international body and who is a dominant force there. And is there any coincidence that what we wound up with was not the established plan, which, as you say, we know works, but something called the China model, which abysmally failed?
Yeah, so it's important to realize that the WHO, actually, you know, they're associated with the United Nations. It gives them credibility, but it's really more than nothing, a multi-story building with a bunch of bureaucrats from around the world inside collecting salaries. They have had their use for non-technical healthcare projects around the world, clean water, improved nutrition, helping well baby clinics. But essentially, the signatory states to the WHO give them money. And in return, these countries have a regional WHO office in their own country. And they go out and do little community medicine projects. Their ability to actually come into a site with a suspected epidemic and to lay out countermeasures and gain control of something like that is zero. And they consistently failed at this type of thing, always a day late and a dollar short. Their current WHO director isn't even a doctor of medicine. And we watched during the first stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, when this guy was making world announcements, reflected on whatever China wanted him to say. You know, you could see the thing was infectious person to person because China was locking down their cities. Yet this guy is saying, Tedros, I can't pronounce his last name. He's saying, no, you know, there's no proof of person-to-person transmission. Well, of course there is. That's why it's a pandemic and spreading. Then it was, well, you know, we're not going to call it a epidemic of unusual concern. Well, it had already passed that stage. And he just downplayed the whole thing the whole time when it was clearly out of control. There's indications, you know, this had started months earlier and had been covered up until they had that big cluster and it couldn't be hidden anymore. Data mining had already picked up that something unusual was happening in China. So the guy's a spokesperson for China. There's no, he wouldn't know what to do in a pandemic if you wrote it out for him. I have a very, very low opinion of the WHO.
Well, and rightly so, I think, based on actual experience. And that was when the WHO, of course, had simply an advisory role. What is going on now, as you know, Doctor, is with the strong support of the Biden administration and the Chinese Communist Party and the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and Big Pharma, the idea that is now inexorably being advanced is to give the World Health Organization actually compulsory powers, the authority to dictate when a nation has a public health emergency of international concern, as it's called, and what it must do about it. Is there anything in its track record to date, including how they managed or mismanaged the pandemic known as COVID-19, that would warrant confidence that this can be done? And especially if it comes at the expense of our sovereignty in public health matters, Dr. Hatfield?
If I was in charge, I would have pulled out of the WHO several years ago, most particularly after the complete fiasco of the 2014 Ebola outbreak. It's just unfathomable. Seriously, these people couldn't organize a beer festival in a brewery. They have no regulatory authority, and it would be complete madness to give them any such thing should the United Nations actually decide to do something that's stupid.
Yeah. Well, and again, just to put a fine point on it, you talked about doctors, you know, consulting with you about proper treatment. The idea here would be that they would not be allowed to do that, that the WHO will tell them whether it's remdesivir or some other drug, that's what you have to use to treat your patient, your discretion as a medical professional notwithstanding. This seems like a formula for disaster to me. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's for the money that's put into it. You know, village health, this type of thing in Africa, but it's become sort of a self-licking ice cream cone, and it's not capable of responding quickly. It has no endogenous resources. If it wants to mount a medical effort, it's completely dependent on other countries and their funding of it. And they're bureaucrats that live in a building. I'm sorry to be so harsh on them because it was a fine idea, but it just hasn't worked out.
Yeah, and it won't work out if it gets this next evolution and power at our expense, specifically of our sovereignty. Dr. Hatfield, we've got just a minute and a half left. Quick question. One of our colleagues on the Team B report, Sam Faddis, is speculating that the next pandemic may well be a fairly common disease, tuberculosis, which he says we have allowed to come into our country in large numbers across this unmonitored border without screening people. There's a concern that the World Health Organization will use a declaration of a new public health crisis involving some pandemic disease as the pretext for getting that additional power. Quick thoughts on whether TB is the likely candidate or others that might be in the offing.
Well, we certainly have a problem with TB in our borders. Tuberculosis has been the great silent killer over the last century, more than a century. It's incredibly difficult to treat. It's very drug intensive. It takes weeks to treat a patient for tuberculosis, and it's very common in the developing world. We've got essentially open borders now. One of the reasons we have borders is so you get a chest x-ray before you come in, so we can see there's no TB. And this has been going on for over 100 years. They've been doing this. Now that's all thrown away. You don't even get a medical exam. And all around that southern border, we have these small informal settlements with about 1 million people scattered across the border called colonistas. These are Latin American, Spanish-speaking communities.
Dr. Hatfield,
that's where you're going to
end up. We're out of time. We're going to wind up in the colonistas, that's for sure, or their diseases with the rest of us. We're going to have to take a short break. Dr. Hatfield, if I could ask you to stay with us, I want to touch on in greater detail this colonista problem and what we are looking at if it turns into the next horrific public health emergency. We'll be right back with Dr. Hatfield right after this.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation. We decided we were leaving things at such a point that we really required a further drill down with one of the world's leading experts on the phenomenon of biological, well, disease, but especially warfare. And Dr. Stephen Hatfield was kind enough to stick with us for a further segment where we will be talking with him about this colonista phenomenon now spread around the United States, and with it almost certainly is being spread a deadly disease, what he has called the silent killer, known as tuberculosis. Dr. Hatfield, again, thank you for your courtesy in extending our visit, and your expertise is so appreciated. You have written a book entitled 3 Seconds Till Midnight, and it seems as though that may well be where we are at the moment with respect to an outbreak of tuberculosis that could have devastating effects on our society and economy. We'll come back to the idea of having the World Health Organization tell us what to do about it, but talk about the problem a bit further and your own recommendations as to what should be done.
Well, with the lack of border control at the moment, we have a massive influx of people from what's called the developing countries of the world. A lot of these are from very poor, impoverished areas. And this is really the home of tuberculosis. I've seen hundreds of cases. I spent almost 20 years in Africa. And two centuries ago, it was probably one of the leading killers of mankind. It's a bacteria, it's not a virus, but it's a very hardy bacteria, and it's inordinately difficult to get rid of. It requires 3 months of intense, multiple type of antibiotic therapy, and then a prolonged phase of treatment. And if during that first 3 months of intense antibiotic therapy, you stop any of the drugs that you're on, you're going to have organism resistance to that drug, and that's what's going to spread until eventually you get what we call extremely drug-resistant strains of pulmonary tuberculosis. And we have these circulating now. And this is where nothing is going to work. So we have the we're going to get cases from the border. The problem is that lining the border, our southern border, are these impromptu impoverished settlements called coladistas. And probably if you take it across Texas, California, there's probably a million people in these areas. There's no running water. There's no formal sewage. They're home-built sort of ramshackle huts. And it's multiple families per room. It's the perfect breeding ground for tuberculosis. And we are behind the curve because right now, in fact, months ago, we should have had healthcare teams sweeping through these areas, taking chest x-rays, or doing PCR tests, or doing diagnostics, and trying to pull out the people with tuberculosis, identify them, and treat them. In addition, there's about 12 areas of our among our 120 largest cities that are, because of poor resource, low income, low socioeconomic status, make perfect breeding grounds for this. We should have teams going through there constantly now. And nothing's going on.
And these include homeless populations of our own.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not just foreign.
But Team B really likes to, it likes close crowded conditions. And I mean, we're not doing any of this. We're not even DNA fingerprinting the children that are coming through the borders now. This is asking for trouble. And once it starts, we don't have the facilities. We don't have TB sanitariums now, like 100 years ago. We don't even make the drugs for it in this country. And like I say, if you don't do that first 3 months of intensive treatment, all you're doing is breeding very strange strains of new tuberculosis. So this is a public health nightmare. You can't put these patients into a normal hospital. We only have a small number. Every hospital has a couple isolation rooms with reverse ventilation so that nothing gets out of it. But you can't do this on the scale that a very large TB outbreak it would occur. And these people will not get better. It's not something you're going to fight off on your own. Once this is firmly established, I mean, half our population, or at least at my age, were exposed. And you're fit, you're healthy, you're well-nourished. You get a tiny little spot on your lung, a scar, and you can see it on x-ray. It's called a gone focus. You were exposed and your body contained it. It's that prevalent in like my age group. So we don't have this now. If this organism comes through here, we're really, really going to have a problem.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions about this, Doctor. You're talking about a spot, does that constitute some kind of immunity against this? If you've had some exposure,
yeah, your body's contained it. It's walled it off. This gone focus. However, if you get under like extreme immunosuppression, like organ transplants, something like that, there's very possibly still live bacteria in it. And you can get a recurrence. It's very, very rare. And, you know, by the time you're much older, it's pretty well walled off. Yeah. But it can happen.
And about the treatments, Doctor, you have said in the course of this program that, they require a fastidious regimen of treatment, And homeless populations and colonista populations, I think, almost certainly are not going to be practicing that, at least in their own, you know, communities. Maybe in an isolation ward, if there were such a place. But tell us, also, you mentioned that they're not manufactured here. Where might they be coming from? And again, that's the drugs that work if you haven't built this kind of immunity to them.
Frank, the drugs come from India and China. We don't even make penicillin in the United States anymore. And, you know, we're having all this trouble with China. What if they shut all this off?
Right. Big time problem. And what if
these drugs have to be given, and they're given at different times. Anybody out there that's on blood pressure tablets, you know, do you remember exactly when to take them every day? Or what if you're on three or four medications? Okay. And you're on this, you're well nourished, you're intelligent, you're not living in a colonista. And if you miss when you're supposed to take those tablets and you drop your plasma levels below minimal effectiveness, you're actually breeding new strains that will be resistant to some of those antibiotics. You've got to take this, and this goes on for weeks, intensive therapy.
This is a nightmare. Doctor,
it really is a public health nightmare.
Yeah. And again, as we were talking about in the last block, one of my great concerns is this is not going to get better in all likelihood if we have some foreign entity like the World Health Organization declaring that we have some tuberculosis, let's say, pandemic or, you know, public health emergency, at least. And what we have to do about it is something that either we can't do or we don't think is the appropriate course of treatment. That would simply exacerbate, I assume, the problem that you're talking about, which sounds bad enough the way it would be.
Again, I would have shut off our contribution to the WHO long ago. Use that money to rebuild our CDC, which is a complete and utter mess at the moment. More busy on spying on what you're saying on the internet and deplatforming you if you go against the traditional doctrine or the vaccines or you promote early treatment. That agency needs to be rebuilt from the bottom up now. And we're running out of time, Frank. You can't have modern society and high-density populations if you don't have public health.
Right.
And
public health,
you know, COVID had a very low death rate. We've lost a million people for something that kills less than 1% fatality. It's ridiculous.
And especially when you think about what may be up the sleeve of the Chinese Communist Party that's far more lethal, or even just this public health nightmare that you've just described for us, the tuberculosis possible.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a BW thing. Mother Nature's meaner than any biological warfare scenario.
Yeah, well, that's a bracing thought. I want to commend to our audience a marvelous article at Substack by our friend Sam Faddis and magazine.com at Substack. I hope you'll check that out, as well as the collected works of Dr. Stephen Hatfill, including 3 Seconds Till Midnight. He is a senior fellow of the London Center for Policy Analysis. We appreciate so much your visit with us, sir. Thank you for giving us an extended opportunity to talk about what do we need to do now. God bless you. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The sad truth is that too many congressional Republicans amount to little more than a controlled opposition, full of rhetorical posturing, but when it matters, doing basically whatever the left demands. In January, Kevin McCarthy was compelled to promise, if elected Speaker, to oppose rather than submit to the Marxists running the executive branch and the Senate. His critics wisely required that the rules enable any one of them to depose him if he reneged. Barely 6 months later, it's clear that Speaker McCarthy has reverted to form. His so-called deal with Joe Biden on the debt ceiling is precisely what the governing leftists expect from opposition figures they control. It should be spurned by the Republican caucus and the Speaker's chair vacated to be filled by someone truly committed to opposing, not enabling, Obama-Biden 3.0's fundamental transformation of America. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Robert Spencer, no stranger to this program, needless to say. In fact, he's one of our regulars, a duty expert on a host of issues of great importance to all of us, notably the focus of his considerable efforts at jihadwatch.org, where he is the director, very important project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And of course, the author of, I think it's 24 books at last count, at least the last one I've seen, including The Sumpter Gambit, which talks about the left's efforts to precipitate a new civil war in the United States. Robert, it's good to have you with us. Welcome once again.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot to mention, among many, many other attributes, you are also a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and the author of, among other things, at Center for Security Policy Press, Who Lost Afghanistan, which I also would commend to our audience. Robert, you've been writing lately, as has your wonderful colleague, Christine Douglas-Williams, about Turkey, a nation that is generally discussed, if at all, in the context of its NATO membership and role. But of late, its president has been going through a bit of an electoral process to see if he would get re-upped. Something that I think is ominous, actually, for NATO and more generally our interests in the Middle East. Tell us about Recep Tayyip Erdogan. What has been the nature of the electoral thrash that has gone on, where it stands now, and its implications both for NATO and for us?
Frank, Erdogan was just reelected as president of Turkey. He has been in power first as prime minister and then as president for the last 20 years. There was widespread hope, particularly among Turkish secularists, the Kemalists, that he would lose this election. And there are charges from the opposition of widespread irregularities. And so it may well be that he did lose the election, but he's going to remain in power. Some people in the opposition have been warning that what he wants to do is turn Turkey into Iran, that is, make it into another Sharia state in which Islamic law is the law of the land. Now, Erdogan himself actually makes no secret of this and has frequently enunciated his desire to do nothing less than restore the Ottoman Caliphate, the last caliphate in Islam that was abolished by the secular Turkish government in 1924. And so this re-election is possibly just a step in that direction. Certainly, he has become increasingly belligerent towards Greece and has specifically stated that all of the territories of the former Ottoman Empire which include at its height substantial portions of North Africa, Egypt, the Middle East, and even parts of Asia, belong to Turkey, mm-hmm. and that he intends to win them back. Now, whether he will now actually dare to go to war with a fellow NATO ally, Greece, or with some of the other countries that used to be in the Ottoman Empire, that remains to be seen. But he's certainly doing quite a lot of saber rattling.
One of the places that, as I recall, the Turks held for a time, at least, was Austria and parts of southern Europe. When they did that, they were ultimately repulsed. But as I understand it, Robert, and you obviously are the duty expert on this, as I say, anything that they had at any point in time is theirs in perpetuity, whether they actually control it at the moment or not. It's theirs by right. And it's of concern, I guess, that we've seen Turks who live in Vienna, for example, in Austria, shouting Allahu Akbar upon the announcement that Erdogan had won a majority in the runoff election that he had to go through as part of that electoral exercise, as I said. Talk a little bit about, well, they're not outside the gates of Vienna, they're inside now. Robert, what is the prospect that this caliphate, or at least Erdogan's ambitions to conjure it up again, would extend that far? And what would the implications again be for Europe as well as for NATO?
It's quite possible, Frank, that the Turkish caliphate could be restored and could make farther inroads into Europe than it did in the Ottoman era. The Ottomans did subdue Eastern Europe and the Southeastern Europe, that is, and got through Hungary, advanced to Vienna, and then, of course, famously on September 11th, 1683, they reached their apex and were repulsed in the early hours of the morning on September 12th, never advanced that far again. But now, with mass migration of Turks into Europe, there are substantial minorities of Turks, not only in Austria, but in Germany. And they very clearly, as their reaction to Erdogan's re-election indicates, have more of an allegiance to their home country than they do to what is ostensibly their new country. And so it may well be that Erdogan, who has toured those countries and called upon the Turks there to retain their Turkish identity, that he will ultimately call upon them to be his kind of vanguard troops in taking over these lands for his new caliphate.
Yeah. And Robert, very quickly, remind us what the phrase Allahu Akbar means literally and signifies symbolically.
It means Allah is greater. It's always translated in the Western media as God is great, which, you know, nobody could really object to. But Allah is greater is a declaration of supremacy and superiority. The idea is that Allah is greater than the God of the Christians or any other God. And consequently, when Muslims say Allahu Akbar, they are declaring the superiority of Islam, which in the context of Muslims in Austria, in a Christian country, historically a Christian country, it's clearly ominous.
Submission, in short, and that's not a pretty thing in Sharia Islam. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer right after this. Welcome back. We are visiting with Robert Spencer about a very well, momentous development in European affairs, also for that matter in the Middle East. We're talking about the re-election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan as the president of Turkey. His aspirations to reconstitute the caliphate with the possible considerable expansion of it into parts of Europe that have been well subjected to, I guess is the right word for it, large numbers of Turks who have migrated for work or other opportunities. And Robert, I guess it's fair to say that they've not generally assimilated much. And you've talked about how Erdogan has encouraged them to remain separate and ultimately perhaps to be mobilized as part of a new, well, jihad to take all of Europe. Is that now in prospect? Obviously, the Turks are one source of the Muslim migration into Europe, but there are Moroccans and others from elsewhere in the Middle East that populate France and other nations there. But how do you see this playing out? And again, this is all being done by a nation that is ostensibly a NATO ally. What's that about?
Well, the NATO alliance is something that really ought to be revisited, but it doesn't look as if anybody in the Biden administration has even any idea that that needs to be done. And oddly enough, even a Democrat senator, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Robert Menendez, recently challenged Secretary of State Antony Blinken about Turkey and how unreliable an ally it has become. Mm-hmm. And Blinken just waved it all away and said, well, yes, they're challenging, but they're far more than challenging. What they are doing is leveraging the mass migration into Europe and their membership in NATO to bring Europe to heel, make it submit in terms of explicit Sharia provisions. And the most notable example of this is Sweden, which has applied to enter NATO in light of the Russian threat. And yet Erdogan is holding up Sweden's admission into NATO because of the burning of a Quran by a private citizen, Rasmus Paludan, not at the behest or with the approval of the Swedish government, but nonetheless, he did it in Sweden, and the Swedish authorities explained to Erdogan and to the world that this was something they had to allow as a matter of the freedom of expression. And he said, you have to outlaw this, or there will be no admission of Sweden into NATO. And now, of course, he's demanding, as kind of a quid pro quo, F-16s from the United States as the condition of his relenting on this and allowing it. So either way, he wins. He gets his F-16s at a time when he's increasingly belligerent towards Greece, and or he gets Sweden to abandon the freedom of expression and adopt essentially what are Sharia blasphemy laws.
Yeah, submission either way, in other words. Yeah. And as I recall, Robert, one of the issues with the F-16s was that he imported S-400 anti-aircraft weapon systems from Russia. And there was a concern that if anybody had both of those weapon systems, they would be able to help the Russians figure out how to most effectively counter one of our frontline platforms, the F-16. This is a bad bit of business, but again, it bespeaks kind of the larger agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And I think you talked about the need for, you know, a revisiting of the NATO alliance under these circumstances. At the very least, there needs to be a revisiting of the idea that there's no way to expel a nation that is a member but has ceased to be an ally. And I think that's clearly where we are. I have to say, I think that the Biden administration, it's not just that they're not particularly troubled about the bad behavior or the worse aspirations of Erdogan. It seems to me that they are obviously under the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood, which benefits massively from Erdogan's support. at the very least, looking the other way and possibly actually quite supportive of whatever it is he has in mind. Very, very troubling indeed. But Robert, let me pivot in the last 2 minutes we have with you to another story, and you chronicle all of these magnificently at jihadwatch.org. And I so commend you for doing this tirelessly, both looking at the Islamist threat here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, as well as the Marxist left and what they're up to. And I guess there's a bit of both of that at play in this last story I want to touch on, and that is a hijab-wearing leftist used his valedictory, I guess, address to the college, City University of New York, rather, CUNY New York Law School, to engage in, well, pretty vile anti-Semitism, among other things. Talk a little bit about that and what that may say about academia in the United States at the moment more generally.
Well, this was a woman named Fatima Muhammad, and she gave a commencement address as the representative of the student body at CUNY Law School. And what's really remarkable about it is how unremarkable it was, that she was indeed viciously anti-Semitic, and not just in opposition to Israel itself. But what she said was within the broad mainstream of American academia today, which is completely dominated by the left. And as the left grows increasingly hostile toward Israel and increasingly identifies its entire agenda with that of the Palestinian jihadis, this kind of rhetoric becomes normalized. And so I'm sure that although there's a furor now, because people are raising protests about it, and CUNY has condemned the speech, and then other leftist groups are condemning CUNY for condemning it, and so on. This, I'm sure Fatima Muhammad had no idea that she was saying anything controversial, because it was the same sort of thing that is said in those classes all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's a sorry state of affairs if there's no recognition that rabid anti-Semitism is beyond the pale, let alone the perception that it is de rigueur, as they say, the norm and expected of you. Robert, thank you for chronicling all of these things and bringing them to our attention and coming aboard from time to time to discuss them. We look forward to our next visit with you very soon. God bless you in the meantime, my friend. Keep up the great work at jihadwatch.org. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.